know.
Because our state also has healthcare workers recently returned from West Africa. In a couple of minutes, you'll meet a nurse from Seattle who is headed to Liberia this weekend. Meanwhile, that nurse in Maine, Casey Hickox, is she a model of rational thinking or selfishness? Or both? You tell us on Facebook. We'll share your thoughts and possibly debate you. Also this hour, is it ever okay to be sarcastic right after a school shooting? We will also round up the highlights of this campaign season. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. We're live tweeting the show, as always, at KUOW. And given the shells underneath Pioneer Square, it is appropriate that our phone number is 206-685-CLAM. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning. Yes, happy Halloween.
Hey, Bill.
News update. In case you haven't heard, a judge has rejected a bid by Maine health officials to restrict the movement of a nurse who treated Ebola patients in West Africa. The judge says Casey Hickox should continue to be monitored daily and should coordinate any travel with state officials. But because she's not showing symptoms, the judge says she's not infectious. Hickox has been resisting efforts to keep her confined to her home in northern Maine until the 21-day incubation period for Ebola ends on November 10th. Now, unlike the state of Maine, Washington State does not impose mandatory quarantines on healthcare workers returning from the Ebola zone in West Africa. One of those healthcare workers heading out this weekend is Swedish Hospital ER nurse Mark Bauma. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Bill. Thanks for having me.
As you watch the case of this defiant nurse in Maine, what's your reaction?
Well, I kind of see it this way. There's two kind of scientific principles. People say the word science, and that kind of makes it true, and it doesn't always make it true. You know, there's a small possibility. It's really remote, but it's very well established that you can be symptomatic. You can spread the disease before you have the symptoms. In the case of the doctor in New York City, he checked his temperature 12 hours before he went to the ER. So he didn't have a temperature 12 hours before, but he could still pass it on in that 12 hours. It wasn't like he didn't have any virus in his system in those 12 hours. And so the other side of the science is it's a well-known fact that you can be infected for 21 days, hence the 21-day quarantine. So for me, my personal belief is that I would rather take the inconvenience of being isolated and quarantined as opposed to any just my new possibility that I could spread the disease to my friends and family in my community. So that's kind of the approach I've taken for myself.
So when you return from Liberia, presuming you're symptom-free, what will you do your first 21 days home? What will it be like for you?
It's very inconvenient. I get back kind of mid-December, so I'm going to spend the holiday season by myself. I'm kind of going out to a hunting cabin by myself out in the woods, and literally I'm not going to be around people for 3 weeks. And I'll have my twin brother is going to be dropping me off food, and I'm not going to have any physical contact with him. But basically, I'm going to completely isolate myself for 21 days.
That's your approach. Do you begrudge this nurse, Casey Hickox, for her approach, her defiance?
Not at all. I think everyone needs to make their own, you know, approach. It's, you know, it's not me. I'm not, you know, all-knowing and all-powerful. So I don't prefer to tell other people how to, you know, run their lives. Personally, I like to, you know, approach my job and my life. I'm a Christian, and I like to be humble, and I like to really kind of err on the side of caution. I think a big part of medical science is do no harm, and I think in some ways, you know, she's scaring a lot of people, and so it's definitely a debate that needs to be had.
On our Facebook page, our listeners are talking about this, and Ken says, locking up volunteers when they return isn't going to encourage people to volunteer. It is far more important to stop the Ebola outbreak where it is now in West Africa. If you knew that Washington State was going to switch and make your quarantine, your hunting cabin holiday, mandatory, would you feel any differently? Would you still go? Would you complain?
It's my expectation as a nurse. We're asking, when we go to Liberia, we're asking the Liberians to quarantine themselves. We're going into their houses and taking their family member's body away, and that's a big deal for them. So it's something that we're asking of the people that we're going to Liberia from. And so when I come back to the States, I'm expecting, and it's part of the kind of the deal, you know, that I have to, you know, protect myself and my family for 21 days. So for me, it's just part of signing up. Everyone that I've talked to, medical providers and non-medical providers, the reason they're not going to Africa has nothing to do with the 21-day quarantine. It's all about the danger involved of getting Ebola themselves and dying. And that's a legitimate concern, and I appreciate that. Not everyone has, you know, the family situation where they can just up and go to Africa, you know, and endanger themselves. And I'm blessed to have that ability in my life. So it doesn't stop me. It doesn't worry me. The 21 days is not a big deal. And for all the workers and all the healthcare workers I've personally talked to, that's not the deal breaker.
It's very brave of you to go. How will you protect yourself while you're there?
Well, again, I'm a Christian, so I really kind of rely on, you know, my faith is going to protect me. But, you know, we're also really well trained. I'm going to the CDC and getting 3 days of training on really expertly putting on and taking off the protective gowns. And, you know, we have a good team I'm going with, and we kind of watch each other's backs and protect each other and really kind of rely on my faith and my training.
I really like the way that you processed this, how you talked yourself through the whole process. And when I was thinking about, you know, what's my position on this, I sort of hate myself on this because I'm of two minds. You know, I get the desire to be, you know, free and able to do what you want to do when you don't have any symptoms. And you've heard plenty of doctors talk that way about Casey Wilcox. But I sort of end up with some of what you were saying, because yours is all about the abundance of caution and using the 21 days as a sort of a calculation in the total package of whether you will go or not and what you will do when you come back. Because the fear is also something we have to deal with.
Absolutely. And I think fear is a very real thing. Ebola is a scary word. It's a scary disease. And the community, healthcare workers, everyone's a little bit afraid of it. But kind of the counter to the fear is knowledge and, you know, and educating yourself on the subject. And the other thing is acting on it. So one thing that I'm really encouraging everyone to do is, if you're afraid of it, you know, look up, you know, unreliable sources, you know, and find out about it. And then also get involved. There's a lot of local charities that are doing some great work. You don't have to fly over to Liberia to help out. You know, Medical Teams International and World Vision and Impact Northwest are local charities that are doing great work, and you can pack medical supplies to get sent over, and you can, you know, give a couple dollars and really kind of get involved in as a way of kind of getting over that fear.
Swedish Hospital ER nurse Mark Boma is headed to Monrovia, Liberia this weekend, and then he'll come back and spend 21 days in a hunting cabin for the holidays. Mark, safe travels to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
What did you learn?
What I had been learning from other stories that I've been reading about the nurses and doctors who go to West Africa, that they are willing to take risks that a lot of us aren't, and that we benefit from that.
This nurse, Casey Hickox, she said that she actually tried to negotiate her way out of the quarantine.
In my negotiations, that was one of the things I was willing to do, that I would only travel in my own private car. I wouldn't take any public transport, and I wouldn't leave the area around Fort Kent, Maine. I think that is something that we can all agree upon as a fair thing to do to keep everyone safe.
Okay, so you can understand why you shouldn't ride the bus. So what is it you do want to do with your freedom?
I'd love to be able to, what is the pizza place's name?
Moose Shack.
Moose Shack. I'd love to be able to go to the Moose Shack in Fort Kent and get an amazing slice of pizza. And again, not be worried about what people are thinking or if I'm going to get arrested by the state trooper if I walk outside of my property.
There's an unsolicited ad for the Moose Shack.
Although maybe they deliver.
Maybe they
indeed
deliver.
Indeed they do. They did deliver in this case. And I think it's so important to consider what the nurse from Swedish was saying about that 12 hours, that you take your temperature and you wait the 12 hours, but some point during that 12 hours, you may or may not become symptomatic. And so he wants to err on the side of caution because of that very small possibility. Again, not everybody wants to do that. But in this case, it seems like the pizza could be delivered or eaten outside, picnic style. I don't know.
Can't America buy her a stationary bike for her home and flowers and, you know, not? She doesn't have to be treated like a pariah, right?
Exactly.
And just
no.
Be like, Chris, you are a hero.
Yeah, I was thinking back to the 1950s when the country was trying to deal with polio outbreak, and the government was trying to figure out whether to order people into quarantine or do voluntary quarantines. my sister had polio while my mother was pregnant with me, and so our house was quarantined for, I think, 2 weeks, something. And the quarantines were very targeted. They wanted to keep little children away from each other, and they wanted to keep they would quarantine teachers as well if teachers were in the classroom. And, of course, polio's not spread through the air, you know, similar to Ebola, but it's obviously a very different disease. But
Ebola is not spread through the air.
That's right. So they're neither of them are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Even though they're very different diseases, but but what was interesting to me about that was they were trying to find this balance between panicking people by quarantining too many people, and stopping polio outbreaks when they happened kind of in their tracks.
Right.
And so I find this very fascinating because we talk about science, but it sounds like the medical community is having an internal debate about the science and about what it means. One question I had was when in that period of time when you might develop it, can't they give you a blood test to see whether or not you have it even before it's symptomatic? In other words,
you mean during the 12 hours?
During the 21 day. In other
oh,
words,
no,
when you
she's
get
had
off
blood
the plane,
tests. She's
doesn't,
clear. She doesn't
she's
have
clear.
Ebola.
So is the science that if you test for it and you don't show it, does it mean that you'll get that?
No,
you
it means that it? You don't become symptomatic until you start. You don't become infectious until you become symptomatic,
right.
Supposedly. But
can't
there are
you
moments
just test people as
the
they
testing.
Come off the plane, give them a blood test.
But it takes 3 weeks to develop or not.
That's what he's asking. Can you test negative when you get off the plane and then test
and then be
positive
okay.
3 weeks later?
Right.
Send us the answer on Twitter or on Facebook, and we'll move on to other topics. Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. Is it ever okay to be sarcastic right after a school shooting? That's our next topic in a moment. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail from the Seattle Channel, Eli Sanders, Associate Editor at The Stranger, and the Mossback at Crosscut.com is Knut Berger. So the latest is that there are two victims in critical condition from this shooting on Friday at Marysville Pilchuck High School, another in satisfactory condition at Harborview. More than 1,000 people attended a funeral yesterday for the 15-year-old who shot these five classmates, killing two and himself. Within hours of that shooting on Friday, Seattle businessman and gun control advocate Nick Hanauer went on Facebook. He posted a link to a story about the shooting with the caption, "We need more school shootings!" 3 exclamation marks. Vote yes on Initiative 591. He was sarcastically referring to a measure on the state ballot that would restrict background checks on gun sales. Hanauer is a top funder for a competing measure, I-594, that would require more background checks. And in the comments section of his post, some people from the 594 campaign said, would you take the post down? Which he did. The Yes on 591 campaign responded, calling Hanauer a bombastic billionaire whose comments were disgusting and sickening. Eli, was Nick Hanauer out of line?
I think he was out ahead of the facts. Usually when school shootings like this happen, and unfortunately there's a routine to them now, it's very, very sad and very, very frustrating. And on that score, I can kind of relate to where Nick Hanauer might have been coming from with his frustration and anger. That's what I hear behind that post. But normally I think it's wise to wait and see where the gun came from. In this case, as I understand it, the gun didn't come from a purchase at a gun show that the kid who did the shooting made.
But his post didn't say that 591 would have affected this shooting. He sarcastically suggested that that measure would result in more school shootings overall.
Know,
isn't
but,
that fair? Whether you agree with him or not, isn't that, you know, a claim he gets to make on Facebook?
Sure. I'm not denying him the right to free speech.
Yes.
What I'm saying is I think that if you're going to use a shooting as a launching pad for an argument in the context of a debate about tougher background checks, it really helps your argument to have the launching pad relate to the argument.
So these two things should not be linked.
That's not what I'm saying either. That's way more universal than what I was saying. I'm saying this specific incident
That's what I'm saying. This specific incident should not be linked to 591 or 594.
I think that it's this specific gun should not be linked to this specific debate because, okay, as I understand it so far, this specific gun wasn't purchased at a gun show without a background check and used in the shooting, you know, in a premeditated fashion. That's the argument for 594 and the argument against 591. 591 preserves a situation where criminals can go to gun shows or even online or Craigslist or whatever and get guns with no questions asked, whereas other people who go to legitimate gun dealerships have to have background checks. It's a crazy system, and 594 would just evenly apply the background check rule. The problem with linking this debate, which is really interesting and really important, to this specific gun and this specific shooting is that the gun is not a good example of the problem.
The gun was purchased legally. It should not be in the hands of a 14 or a 15-year-old. But I do think it's time to separate Nick Hanauer from his cell phone for just a couple of reasons. Because, you know, Facebook, love it. There you go. It does not lend. It's just like email. Some people can tell sarcasm in an email or a Facebook post, but a lot of people cannot. And so his post, and he was wise to take it down. At what point did he take it down? I don't remember that. But the gist of it is you have a shooting, you have everybody super vulnerable and upset, and here comes this sarcasm. It just doesn't help your cause.
You know, people around a tragedy like that, people like there to be some kind of sacred zone where politics doesn't matter for
right.
a while. Now, I learned that in the Oso thing where a couple weeks after the Oso event, I wrote a column about what I thought the politics of the mudslide would be. And I was excoriated by one of the writers at the Everett Herald who thought that I had just done something horrible because I was bringing up the issue of politics way too soon. So I know that politics will come into just about everything, but people like to maintain a buffer.
Is that for victims, their families? Is it for ourselves?
I think people want to be able to feel their grief.
Uh-huh.
I think it's about grieving. It's like why we don't want protesters at funerals. You want to have an experience that is above all of that, because most people know sooner or later it's all going to get down in the mud anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it's
but that makes politics out to be the mud.
But I just like to say that, well, I think it generally is. I mean, if
public
you
policy.
Watch political ads and yeah. you know, see the mailers that are being drawn, politics doesn't have, if you look at congressional ratings or the ratings of how we think of the legislature, I saw a poll recently where people in Eastern Washington registered approval of the state legislature at 0.08%. Right. I think cockroaches
like
get get a better rating. So I think part of it is. But that said, I don't think people should make a big deal out of the Hanauer thing. It was kind of a shoot from the hip comment. That's kind of what Facebook and Twitter are all about. If they're not about shoot from the hip comments, then why are we so fascinated by them? So I don't think it's a major offense on his part.
On Facebook, Nick says guns are still needlessly killing people. Sometimes sarcasm is all you have. But Mike says Hanauer's pushing a bill that would have prevented neither this nor the Sandy Hook shooting. Taking advantage of a tragedy to push your ineffective agenda. That's a class act. That's Mike being sarcastic about Nick Hanauer's sarcasm on KUOW's Week in Review. We'll be back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter. In 2007, the FBI was trying to track down someone who was calling in bomb threats to Timberline High School near Olympia. So they sent the suspect a link to a fake Associated Press news story with the headline, "Technology Savvy Student Holds Timberline High School Hostage." The suspect, a 15-year-old student, clicked the link, which let malware into his computer. He was found guilty, expelled from school, and sent to juvie. Associated Press reporter Tim McGuire quotes his own company.
AP spokesman Paul Colford says the FBI's writing of a fake story under the AP's name violates the association and undermines the news service's credibility.
Knute, was this good police work or abuse of the press?
Both. And, you know, I mean, they caught the guy, so it's hard to argue with the results. But, you know, I'm on the side of the AP here. I mean, I think it's really, really dangerous to have government agencies pretending to be legitimate news organizations. And I think it just undermines a general confidence that what you're getting, especially with something like the AP, like the Associated Press, which is ostensibly dedicated to objective, just the facts reporting. And,
right.
And so it's really corrosive, I think.
Although, you know, the public confidence in journalists also hovers in cockroach and
slightly
politician
above.
Level.
I think we're more like locusts.
Locusts.
maybe a step up.
And this doesn't help.
No. It doesn't. And I mean, the law enforcement has used and uses the media from time to time for activities like this. I remember at Seattle Weekly, the cops put in fake classified ads to trolling for Johns, you know, that kind of thing, or to bust up prostitution rings. They didn't do it regularly, but I know, in fact, they did it. And but I think that's different than actually putting out a fake news story. And if they wanted to do such a thing, you know, I think you'd have to find a news organization that was willing to cooperate, even though I think that would be bad judgment. They might have found one.
Well, even though journalism and newspapers are down there with the locust, I guess it was, you know, the one thing that they have going for them is that they are trusted. And so as soon as somebody sees the FBI using a fake AP story, they're together then in their minds, and they're not to be trusted. They're working for somebody else. So that's why all the indignation at it, you know.
And it's bad for our democracy if people don't trust journalists with information. And if the FBI undermines that trust, they are undermining our democracy. The spokesperson for the FBI, when a reporter at The Stranger, Ansel Hertz, asked her about this, said, well, you know, what's the difference between impersonating a reporter and impersonating a dentist? Like, there's this very kind of cavalier, like, you are just like any other profession response. And actually, you know, in a way, that's true. A lot of professions operate on a currency of trust. Dentists do, actually. You trust them with a lot of personal information. Doctors do. Remember when the CIA impersonated a vaccine doctor in Afghanistan and undermined the fight against polio, I believe, in Afghanistan as a result of it, and promised that they wouldn't do this again because the costs were not worth the gain? There's something similar going on here. The FBI needs to weigh much more carefully the cost of impersonating a journalist or even a dentist. And it's dispiriting to hear a kind of cavalier attitude about both coming out of the local bureau office's spokesperson.
So the FBI might say, if in some theoretical world you knew that we stopped a murder by apprehending this bomb threat suspect, then would the cost and gain equation change for you?
The problem with those scenarios is that you don't know how else it could have been stopped.
So is it clear whether this is even legal or not?
I think the courts are going to end up deciding that. I would be very surprised if the Associated Press doesn't take some legal action against the FBI for doing this. And which was the member of the Congress was talking about this the other day?
Leahy,
talking about this and saying, you know, what's going on here? He writes a letter to Eric Holder and says, is this really how you do your operations? And so all but saying we're in deep trouble here.
Yeah, it also treads not just into the press, undermining press trust, but treads into the area of linking that to surveillance of what you're looking at, because the link was specially embedded so that the FBI could immediately track the link back to the kid who was making the threats and clinked on it. So it wasn't just that the kid read a fake story and did something. It was that by clicking on that very story, he was directly informing the FBI as to what he was doing. You can imagine that technology in catching criminals has to be used very judiciously. And this kind of thing makes you wonder if they're using good judgment. They did say this kind of a case was rare, which means even they don't like to do it. But it also may mean that there are people in charge who are making decisions that aren't fully thought out, as Joni suggested.
And I believe what Leahy has asked for is an accounting of how many times the FBI has used this tactic nationwide.
KUOW, Ross Reynolds talked to the ACLU's privacy researcher. Christopher Segoyan asked whether the FBI has a history of impersonating news organizations, and he said, we don't know. The FBI doesn't tell judges who they're about to impersonate, and that's not all the FBI does.
We learned in December, for example, that the FBI has had the capability for many years to hack into people's webcams and turn on the camera without the light turning on. That's a really creepy technique, and you know, I think many people, even those who support generally what the FBI does, would be uncomfortable to learn that the government can control the webcam or microphone in your computer. That is over the creepy line, I think, for many reasonable people.
That vaults over the creepy line.
I mean, at least
Joni and I are both covering up the webcam.
Covering
our... Oh, I see.
I was going to say, well, and at least Bon Huberman is here in the studio, and we can see what she's doing.
Yes, our social media
keep
producer.
Keep your eye on that one.
She's the one to watch. The interloper of KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with the Knute Berger from Crosscut.com, Eli Sanders of The Stranger, and Joni Balter of Seattle Channel. And in a moment, new revelations of who gets to lobby who, the revolving door and attorneys general. That's next. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. By the way, the rocket that exploded this week, carrying hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment, a satellite built by a Redmond company. I watched this rocket and the engine and the satellite and all the electronics explode in a fireball and disperse over the coast. And I thought of the microwave oven sitting in my trunk that I was going to take to a recycling plant in order to keep our environment clean.
Good for you.
We're all wasting our time, aren't we? In the big picture, in 4 seconds, that rocket wiped out every bit of environmental good that you and I and all our descendants will ever do.
And on that cheery note.
And well, yet, tonight I will still carefully put my milk jug in one bin and the lid to my milk jug in a different bin.
I was just feeling sorry for the guys on this space station who are like, wow, there goes our pizza. You know?
Indeed it does.
KUOW's Week in Review. So you know that lobbyists try to influence your legislators, have for a long time. But what companies have been apparently catching on to more lately is the lobbying of state attorneys general, current and former. This week, New York Times reporter Eric Lipton wrote about this increasing corporate influence on chief prosecutors.
Corporations are paying as much as $125,000 apiece simply to gain greater access to attorney generals, to be able to socialize with them, to build relationships with them in an effort to try to limit the likelihood that they will be targeted in an investigation.
One example in this article, our own state attorney general, Bob Ferguson. The New York Times reported that Ferguson solicited donations from the company that makes 5-Hour Energy Drink while his office was investigating that company for alleged deceptive marketing. State Attorney General Bob Ferguson told KUOW that his office returned the donation and this drink company got nothing for it.
I was one of just a handful of attorneys general that actually filed a lawsuit against 5-Hour Energy. My point is, yes, I received lots of campaign contributions. That's part of my life as an elected official running for office, but making a donation to my campaign will not buy you any favor or any leniency from my office. They made a $1,000 donation. They were upset about it, so I returned it. But it did not change my course of action, which when I decided later on they were violating our Washington state consumer protection laws. My job is to hold them accountable and file that lawsuit.
Joni Balter, is attorney general lobbying any shadier than lawmaker lobbying?
Well, I don't know about that, but I think that the trend that we are seeing, and this is for sure, that there is more and more money action coming into state legislative races, governor's races, and now, we didn't really think about it or talk about it, attorneys general. Think about this equation. Attorneys general, they're the public's lawyer. We expect very sort of high-level accountability and good conduct from all of them. But here's what's going on. So they go to these conferences. They're often at a beach. Everybody
in warm places, oddly.
Warm places that just kind of blow your mind that that's where they are. And they're schmoozing. They're emailing. There's a lot of, you know, folks who just went out of office as attorneys general or who worked for those folks. They go over to the other firm. Maybe it's T-Mobile, Microsoft, or 5-Hour Energy. They stay up all night after they take the 5-Hour Energy, of course, because, you know, that's what you do. But so what you have is this sort of smushing around of money, and everyone getting to know everyone, or everyone already knows everyone because they used to work together. And so that is creating something that needs to be looked at. There's no doubt. And in these stories, as you noted, Bob Ferguson was mentioned, but he did, in fact, file the lawsuit after the schmoozing went on. But others dropped their cases. The Missouri Attorney General was investigating and dropped the case. So there's a distinction there, of course. But what you have is, and I think it's a great question, so once you leave an office of attorney general, should there be like a time frame when you cannot lobby, email, schmooze on behalf of clients?
Which we have for many legislators, this revolving door laws.
And if we had here, perhaps would have kept Rob McKenna, sometimes guest on the show, mm-hmm. former attorney general of Washington State, Republican candidate for governor, from doing what he did, which was spin around in that revolving door with amazing speed.
Pretty quickly.
Left office and hooked up with Microsoft and T-Mobile, who he had been prosecuting while he was in office, and now he was lobbying the attorney general on behalf of Microsoft and T-Mobile.
Yeah, should there be any different? Should the revolving door legislation be any different? Lawmaker, attorney general? Why? And if so, why was it ever any different at all?
Yeah, well, to some degree, it all sounds like lawyers being lawyers, And I mean, why did Rob McKenna get hired by a high-powered law firm? You know, I mean, it was because of his contacts. So if he's getting in touch with Bob Ferguson saying, hey, Bob, would you hear me out on this? You know, it's that special access. So we all kind of know that goes on. We kind of wink about it. The question is, if somebody like Rob McKenna gets back into the political arena, as some people expect him to, you know, this will be something that will need to be scrutinized greater. And the same for Bob Ferguson, if he decides to run for governor or run for reelection. I think it's great that the New York Times is looking at this, because it seems like, you know, states have been, you know, when you have gridlock in Congress, the action is at the states.
Right.
The states are legalizing marijuana. The states are legalizing same-sex marriage. The states are dealing with abortion. The states are even trying to deal with immigration. And many attorneys general's offices have moved to consumer protection over the recent decades. And both Ferguson and McKenna touted themselves as consumer protection guys. Well, they're going to attract all the big money that's flowing around politics, because especially since the attorney generals are getting together and filing suits so that they have national impact, like we did with on the tobacco.
It all flows from the tobacco.
Exactly. Big tobacco. All the attorney generals got together. They got a huge settlement from big tobacco. The states, divided the money. And so these things have become lucrative for states. They're a way that the states can generate revenue. Well, you can imagine all the corporate interests that now want to be in there and want a seat at the table before those actions are taken.
Coincidentally, the leader of the attorneys general at the time who did the tobacco settlement was former Washington attorney general and governor Christine Gregoire. And the states reap tons of money. And the New York Times also had a story today talking about that if the states are the laboratories or where things may get done, that increases the pressure financially to be buddies with your friendly attorney general.
Who thinks this reporting materially hurts Rob McKenna's shot at governor? Is this something that raises the pulse of Washington state voters?
Sure.
He's a lobbyist now?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you want his kind of rep as attorney general is tied up in a sense of like rectitude and righteousness and representing the people. That's what you want.
Does it have to begin with an R?
No, but today's the day for alliteration, I guess. And if you can undermine that sort of aura that he's put around himself during his years as attorney general, then he loses some rationale, I think, for being our governor. I mean, all of these positions, you want defenders of the people. You don't want someone who's bought and sold by big business.
By the way, we invited Rob McKenna on to KUOW to respond to this, and he declined. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and we're going to be right back and keep clam in just a moment. Stay tuned. Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, The Stranger's Eli Sanders, Crosscut's Knute Berger. I'm Bill Radke with The Week in Review. Next up, the Seattle waterfront tunnel machine got stuck, so they had a tunnel to help the tunneler. Last week that got stuck thanks to a possible Native American refuse pile. Knute Berger, what happened this week?
Well, this week, so what they thought they might have run into in digging the rescue shaft for Bertha is they thought they might have run into a Native American shell midden, basically prehistoric garbage dumps. And they are considered by federal standards to be archaeologically significant. They often contain human remains, often artifacts. They're built up over hundreds of years usually. So archaeologically, they're significant. So they ran into a pile of shells, and it wasn't accidental. It wasn't like the beach. It was something. And so they stopped the digging. They have archaeologists go into the pit. They start doing the kind of archaeological systematic looking at everything. And what they found, and this is still not 100% determined, but what they think they found, according to their internal memos and whatnot, is a pile of shells probably from a commercial 19th century shellfish business. And it could be anything from people who were harvesting oysters and clams and shipping them to San Francisco, or it's in an area where a lot of saloons were, and early Seattle saloons. Somebody described it to me as like, 1860s happy hour refuse pile.
Uh-huh.
It could be stuff that was dumped there by the restaurants or saloons that back in the 1860s, oysters, everybody had to serve oysters. They were very popular. Coffee, cake, and oysters. So it's not a whole lot different than Seattle today.
Yeah. Did you see the Bon Appetit spread that said it was this big picture of Puget Sound and it called it Oyster Land? Just, reveling in the fact that we don't sell as many Olympia oysters as we used to, but plenty of oysters in there. It's big business again.
Yeah,
so you
still a big,
it again.
It's a revival of the 19th century. It was huge business in the 19th century. It went dormant for many years, but then they've brought oysters back and they grow other non-native oysters now. So,
well, what if the shells were thrown there by Duwamish tribal members in the 19th century? Did they become uninteresting as soon as Europeans showed up?
Well, that's a really interesting thing about the whole archaeology down there. If it's post-European American settlement, it's considered historic. If it's before that, it's prehistoric. Prehistoric stuff seems to have a higher standard. The more recent stuff is considered garbage, basically, from an archaeological standpoint. But it's also true that many of the people who harvested those shellfish were Native Americans. It's also true that very near the pit is a place that was a traditional Native American campsite. So they know that area could have, and other projects on the waterfront over the years have turned up Native bones and other kinds of artifacts. So they have to be very sensitive, very careful. They are consulting with, five different Indian tribes that have an interest in that archaeological site and saying, here's what we found, here's what it looks like. So they're going through it very carefully. But I think the stuff that's down there that they consider undifferentiated fill, namely not worthwhile, I think that stuff is actually very, very interesting. You've got layers from the old Seattle fire and other things down there.
And isn't there a history of large projects being halted or rerouted because of discovery of Native American artifacts? I think you talked about it a little potentially in the context of 520. There was a Hood Canal Bridge.
Canal Bridge had the big one, right?
The big pontoon construction project cost the state, tens of millions of dollars because they ended up building on a Native American graveyard, basically, that they should have known about. It was a huge fiasco, cost a lot of people their jobs. There have been other projects on Whidbey Island up near Blaine. This thing happens. We have very strong laws regarding Native American remains now. So, and I was surprised to learn some years ago that middens frequently have human remains in them.
But this did not, right?
Well, it's so they don't believe it's a midden, and they haven't found any remains.
And are there archaeologists who stand there with the digging machines and watch? Is that a full-time job?
Yeah, the way it works.
Maybe they just call them in when they need them.
No, the way it works is they actually have like a little crow's nest, like an observation post above the dig site, and they have binoculars, and they're actually watching as it goes, and the people are instructed also down in the pit what to look for. The archaeologists only go into the pit when somebody says, well, we found something, come down and take a look. And so that's what's going on now, is they're down there assessing and continuing to dig. They'll come up with some kind of determination on what they've found. But they didn't really expect to find much of anything, so this was a surprise. They've done boring samples in the area, and they were pretty convinced that where they were digging, they would get down to the original beach, and that part of the beach was underwater a long time ago. Wow. So they were taken a little bit by surprise, but they're being cautious.
Hey, it's Bertha. There are no surprises.
I was going to say, after finding a surprise pipe, they're now surprised about shells.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's the one thing we know about this project, is when you dig in that area, you're going to find the unexpected. Expect the unexpected. That's what's happening.
And expect it to halt the project.
Although there were some archaeologists all along saying, you better dig carefully because there's interesting stuff down there no matter what.
Who pays for that archaeologist who sits in the crow's nest? Is it the construction team?
Yeah, it's part of the contract that's worked out. They have to provide a certain level. The state has to approve your plan, the contractor's plan for archaeological monitoring.
One of my favorite little things to come out of this is the description that the Seattle Times ran, citing oysterguide.com, of the taste of the Olympia oyster, which is rare. It was almost extinct, it sounds like, and is now slowly making its way back. But according to oysterguide.com, they have an unmistakable, sweet, metallic, celery salt flavor.
Who doesn't love Olympia oysters? Those are the best.
Well, the reason they almost became extinct was they were so popular in San Francisco during Seattle's frontier period that we were loading ships up with every oyster we could get, shipping them to San Francisco and all those gold rush. Mark Twain loved Olympia oysters.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And the thing is, you could get them from Seattle to San Francisco before they would go bad. They also had oysters coming from Mexico, but those without refrigeration, they didn't last very long.
Not as popular. Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and the Week in Review back after this. KUOW's Week in Review, buzzing about the election. That's where we're going to wrap up this hour. I was just telling my friends here that I got this. It was big. It was like a placard in the mail. It said, public records show that you're a frequent voter. You know, da-da-da, and they're encouraged. And I'm looking around. It's paid for by Yes on 594, but it's very you had to look to find that. But it just seemed, to me, the vibe was, public records show everything you do. So you know what I mean? Like, we're watching you.
I have a theory about this.
Tell me.
Because a friend of mine got the same thing. Public records show that you're a frequent voter, and we really want to get your attention about Prop 1A, the preschool measure. And she hadn't voted yet. You probably haven't sent in your ballot yet. You might actually, I don't want to assume, but be an infrequent voter. Who knows? And so it's this kind of reverse psychology thing where they flatter you with the idea that you are a frequent voter. You feel guilty because you're not. And then you pay attention to what they've sent you and use it to fill in your ballot on these complicated measures, which for the average person, 591 versus 594 is kind of complicated. 1A versus 1B is also complicated.
I have missed voting before. I've voted. I'm kind of sporadic, you know. So I thought the same thing. Like, they know a lot about me, and I'm a better voter than I thought. Anyway, listen. I want to know what you have to say about what are your top election stories this time around, Joni?
Top election issues could be I'm all over the two gun measures, and just like Eli said, they are confusing to people who are just approaching their ballot. And they're going, huh? You know, what does some of this mean? I think the gun issue is really important here because, you know, this is one time where the lawmakers are not involved, lawmakers who are supposedly afraid of the NRA and who appear to be. This is about the voters deciding what they want to do about something fairly simple, background checks, or being scared off by the language of Initiative 591, which appears first on the ballot and talks about confiscating guns without due process, and most of us don't want anything without due process. And why are we talking about confiscating? We've been over some of that.
But that strategy might work. Instead of trying to oppose 594, these both might well pass.
Yeah, it was interesting. The KCTS Matt Barreto poll showed that the 591, the anti-background checks thing, was basically 50-50.
No, it was at 45%, actually, which is close to what Elway had. Elway had 39%.
Oh, I thought it was a little higher than that. When I 45. Added up the probables and the definites and the maybes, it was very close. And they've lost a lot of ground. And it looked like the 594 had a very good chance of passage, even though it's come down.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating if they both pass to figure this out. Eli Sanders, top story in the election this time around.
I agree about gun control. I think another kind of dueling measure situation here in Seattle is Prop 1A versus Prop 1B on preschool. And that fight is so confusing. We have 6 minutes left, but there's not enough time in 6 minutes to even explain it.
Hmm.
Prop 1B... The stranger is endorsed, so this I can do quickly. We think Prop 1B is a good step toward universal preschool in Seattle, but Prop 1A has a lot of people arguing passionately for it as well. Anyway, I think that is going to be confusing for people, and when you have people confused, you get strange outcomes. The other big issue in Seattle is the metro vote. Will people vote to dedicate more revenue to Metro, even though there has been some good news about Metro funding over the last few months, but not enough in a lot of people's view and in our view to justify not adding more resources to this struggling transit agency. And then there's that sleeper thing of the sleeper measure about the monorail, which no one really realized was even going to get on the ballot, and no one's really heard much from since. But who knows? People want better transportation solutions. They might just, as they're cruising down the ballot, say, hey, this is not a bad idea. Let's have a monorail, too. The stranger opposes, for the first time in our history, a monorail measure in this
election. Lordy, lordy, lordy.
Because the people behind it are, to just wrap one word around it, flakes. We don't trust them with the public money that would come from this vote.
Can I add one more to the confusion pile here? And that would be Initiative 1351 statewide class size. So you've got this question of, hey, don't you all love smaller class sizes? And you have these ads showing kids super bunched together in a classroom, except they don't mention that just like its predecessor, Initiative 728 from a long while ago, they don't have any money for this, and they will further complicate state budgeting. But since we're all not walking around as state budgeters, we're like, yeah, class size, yeah, I want it smaller.
Yeah, and it looks like it's going to pass from the polling anyway with like 60% approval. People love the concept. They just don't necessarily want to pay the bill, but they love the they love the idea. The thing I'm watching is the state Senate. And will the Republicans get full control? If so, by how many votes? Will they need Democratic crossover votes or not? I've been out in some of the swing districts doing reporting on that. And so I think they're going to make it. I think they're going to get control, which I think.
Why is it important whether it's control or coalition control?
Yeah. Well, because of the coalition, they had to they had to moderate certain things. There were some Democrats that ran certain committees, and it was effectively controlled by the Republicans. But they'd like to have everybody the full power in their caucus and not have to make deals with any Democrats.
It's a way of moderating, not doing transportation, which was sitting in front of them for 2 years. You can just, you know, make this crazy coalition that then doesn't get any of that done.
Okay, before we run out of time, do I hear from all three of you that this is an unusually unpredictable election because of how confusing this ballot is?
There are unusually unpredictable elements, but to me it's an unusually important ballot because of the number of things on it that are really important for the state and for the city. Metro, gun control, transportation in terms of monorail, universal preschool, as Knut said, control of the state Senate. These are huge issues.
So you're saying turnout ought to be higher than what anybody thinks it's really going to be?
We hope.
Well,
they've
even
made it easy at The Stranger. We've got a whole election guide and cheat sheet that helps you get through this.
I printed it out.
Good.
Yeah. I'm a cheater.
We know that. That same information that tells them that you're...
Bill Radke is a frequent cheater.
Right. Yes.
How are you guys doing with the weather, by the way? Holy mother of all things sacred.
Yeah, well, didn't you know after the best summer ever that we were going to pay a pretty hefty price?
I'm
outside. There it is.
Getting to me a little bit.
Yeah, it hasn't bothered me yet, but it does take a little extra to get me out of bed in the morning.
My power went out for a day and a half this weekend. A lot of fallen tree limbs on Mercer Island, which means the attack of the leaf blowers. Do people use leaf blowers near you in Seattle? I want to say this to people who use leaf blowers. Why? Why do you get too much exercise as it is? Your doctors advise you to be less physically active and to avoid rakes. Do you not own a rake? Are they too inexpensive and lightweight for you and practical? My colleague Guy Nelson says he saw a guy using his leaf blower to blow leaves off of his trees. He was aiming it upward. But here's the thing. Once you've bought into a leaf blower, doesn't that make actually perfect sense? You're already using the thing. You're going to use it again when the rest of the leaves fall. Let's do this right now. Is there not enough carbon monoxide in the air for you? Is that the problem? Or there's too much peace and quiet in the world? You suffer from neighbor napophobia, the disabling fear that someone near you is enjoying his rest? Or perhaps you don't like organic material mixing with your yard. I get that. That is terrifying. But unless you can provide me a single reason to use a leaf blower that is not lazy, selfish, or stupid, I'm going to have to slip into your shed at night and load your leaf blower with musket balls.
Well.
Wow.
This has been building.
Is that extreme?
No, I approve. I completely approve. And there's city council members who agree with you and tried to introduce a measure to ban them a while back.
KUOW's Week in Review, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, produced by Jason Pagano. I'm Bill Radke. That's all our time. Let's do this again next week.